Welcome to Not Artificially Sweetened, a weekly podcast where we reflect on all things diabetes. Your hosts are specialist physician Stan Landau and diabetes specialist nurse Michael Brown. We are passionate about using our talents to change lives for the better. Our mission is to build bridges of insight and understanding between people with diabetes and the health professionals that facilitate their care. Nothing is off the table here as we discuss real people, their real issues and stories, and together discover real answers to many vexing practical issues in diabetes and its management.
Hello, everybody. This 49th episode of Not Artificially Sweetened is brought to you by the CDE Online Pharmacy and its range of the CDE MyWell reduced calorie products, specifically designed to assist people with type 2 diabetes to potentially reduce their medication burden, costs, and even achieve remission of their diabetes condition. These CDE MyWell reduced calorie products are currently in the form of very low kilojoule meal replacement shakes, and these come in three delicious flavors, including strawberry and cream, Madagascan vanilla, and creamy chocolate. Backed by sound research evidence, these shakes are high in protein to prevent muscle wasting, high in fiber to increase satiety and reduce appetite, and additionally, they're gluten-free and low in saturated fat. Importantly, they contain the full spectrum of essential vitamins and minerals, thus preventing any nutritional deficiencies developing specifically during a medically supervised, therapeutic, very low-calorie diet and paired behavior change and lifestyle program. Check out the CDE MyWell range in the CDE Pharmacy or online at cdeonline.co.za/MyWell. Welcome, Michael Brown.
Hi there, Stan. Great to be back again. It's just you and I today.
That's not bad for our 49th. We're almost 50 not out, and we hope to invite our listeners back to join us for our next episode. Remember, listeners, you can find us on many social media platforms, including our favorites, such as Spotify, Pocket Casts, the Apple Podcast platform, as well as the Listen mobile audio app. Don't forget to give us a like and a share widely on your social media. And many thanks to those of you who've kept your comments and thoughts coming through on podcast at cdediabetes.co.za.
Please also remember, listeners, that each week we offer you a selection of questions and reflections on each episode. We'd encourage you to take part in these polls to cement your learning and to reflect on what you heard. So, Stan, what are your thoughts clinically for the week? What have you come across that's sort of changed your way of thinking or practice?
Well, this past week, probably more out of chance than anything else, and it has been a short four-day week as we come out of the Easter weekend, I've actually seen a lot of people in their 90s and older, including a centenarian this past week.
Wow.
It made me thinking that very often the doom and gloom that pervades the news with diabetes, that if you develop diabetes, you know, you can lose 10 years of your life as a given. And I think that actuarial data from a population point of view is obviously true when looked at large population volumes. But per patient, I think these people are doing remarkably well. Many have had diabetes for more than 20, even 30 years and have lived comfortably with their diabetes over that period of time. And therefore, I would say that if diabetes is well managed and the risks that go hand in hand with diabetes are well managed, longevity is not something that shouldn't be strived for. And these are well people in their 90s. They're mobile, they're active. Many of them are living in some form of assisted care and some are living independently. And I think it's great to see that that enthusiasm for the management of diabetes, which may well have changed over the life course, is certainly something worthy of making our listenership aware that it is not inevitable that a diagnosis of diabetes happens to cut your life short simply because of the diagnosis.
Oh, sure. That's wonderful news, Stan. And I think it attests to putting into practice the outcomes of trials like the DCCT and the UKPDS many years ago and our clinic experience that have taught us how to manage this condition to improve short and long-term outcomes and quality of life.
I will say this, though, Michael, is that whilst the common thread of managing the glucose levels is consistent from early onset type 1 diabetes in toddlers right the way up to late onset type 2 diabetes in people in their 90s and even older, there's a lot of other stuff that comes along with the care of the older person with diabetes. Now, inevitably, this population may have many features that accompany that chronological age scenario, whether it be chronic pain as a result of musculoskeletal or orthopedic issues. A lot of these people are on what we refer to as polypharmacy. You know, more than three or four different types of medications for three or four different kinds of medical conditions. They often are associated with constipation and change in bowel habits. An older person is certainly at risk of falling, and for some, will certainly lose their executive or cognitive functioning and their ability to kind of look after the day-to-day financial matters and keep their affairs in order. And that makes the complexity of care much more challenging. And for practitioners and healthcare workers who are seeing the older person with diabetes, it's important to pause for a moment and just recognize that there's a lot going on over and above just the blood glucose levels. And where possible, it's nice to make use of the care of the elderly specialist. I don't like the word geriatrician. I like the concept of care of the older person. And there are a number of specialists around Johannesburg and even fewer perhaps around the country.
Right.
And I think it might be worthwhile, where necessary, bringing that extra person into the diabetes care team.
Absolutely, Stan. Thanks for that very pertinent reminder. Sooner than later, because they do have a special set of insights and skills, particularly focusing on the care of the older adult. Well, we know that GLP-1 receptor agonist drugs have been in the news a lot in the last year, drugs like Ozempic, and it's back in the news again, but from another perspective. The antiviral service provider Kaspersky warns of cheap online deals for this so-called revolutionary weight loss drug that may be fake and lead to stolen money and data. So just be careful, listeners. This is a drug that you are trying to get hold of through means that are not necessarily part of your normal pharmacy approach, that you may be signing your life away, providing data that could be used against you. So just watch out for that.
You know, so interesting to hear about GLP-1. Everybody wants to get their hands on these drugs.
Right.
We've spoken at length about that from a weight loss point of view and the impacts on social media. But just this week past in the New England Journal of Medicine, there was an article published on looking at one of these long-acting GLP-1 injection treatments and its role in Parkinson's disease. And in fact, the data said that even up until a year, it can help people preserve their movement and their motor functionality with Parkinson's. So it's great to know that these so-called diabetes drugs are exclusively used for weight loss, as many people perceive it, are in hot demand for people with conditions perhaps beyond diabetes. But also, unfortunately, as you say, Michael, the nefarious side of matters there and criminality seeping in.
Right. That bit of news from the journal just shows us how complex the human physiology is and that hormones like GLP-1 have so many receptor sites and so many pathways which that hormone and its related drugs can activate.
I think because the word complex often comes up in the setting of the care of diabetes, let's just pause for a moment and think about how we're going to introduce our podcast this week. I think if a person comes into our clinic or anywhere in the world with a diagnosis of diabetes being made for the first time, whether you're a person with type 1 or perhaps a parent of a young child who's been diagnosed with diabetes, or perhaps a middle-aged or an older adult with type 2 diabetes, or perhaps you've fallen pregnant and in the course of your pregnancy you've developed gestational diabetes, care can often be very complex and care can often seem fragmented for people with diabetes. A little bit of this, a message here, a TV ad there.
Right.
And I'm very grateful that over the last couple of years, in fact, not that long, I think since the late 1980s, 1988, 1989, the American Diabetes Association were the first grouping globally to put together a very nice roadmap for how best to approach the care of diabetes as it becomes a more and more complex condition to manage. You know, in the early days, Michael, it was pretty easy. You had a finger prick tester. You could only take one or two kinds of pills because that's what the market had at that point of time. And you generally saw a practitioner who worked in isolation, a very paternalistic approach, as we've spoken about before. And were kind of given a gold star or told off that you weren't doing so well. And we both recognize that the nature of care has changed and we're much more inclusive with people in the team. And perhaps I can get you then to bring us into the podcast this week to tell us why we've chosen our particular idea on facilitating positive health behaviors and well-being with the intention of improving outcomes for people with diabetes.
Absolutely, Stan. It's a huge topic. And yes, whilst the pharmaceutical therapies that we need and use in diabetes management are great, they will never, ever work to their optimum potential without a firm foundation of self-management and behavior change, including lifestyle measures that will support the efficacy of these medications. Now, when you get a sore throat, as we've discussed before, in the acute setting, you toddle off to the doctor, you're sick, you're sore, you say to the doc, I'm not feeling well, you get an antibiotic, and the doctor says, well, take this antibiotic 3 or 4 times a day, before, after, or during meals, or whatever, and complete the course, and come back and see me if you don't feel better. And of course, we know that chronic conditions like diabetes, heart failure, asthma, and so on, require a lot more self-directed management, in addition to taking the prescribed medications. and especially in diabetes, often regarded as the prototype for all chronic health conditions, huge amount of behavior change is needed to facilitate the best outcomes that we're trying to achieve. And this includes things like taking medications, healthy eating, being physically active, engaging in social support to help you achieve your self-management aims, monitoring your outcomes, avoiding risks like smoking or excessive alcohol use or the use of drugs like cannabis or cocaine, reducing unhealthy behaviors, and decision-making, which can be influenced by a variety of things, including duration and quality of sleep, the presence or absence of anxiety or depression or stress, and the burden of the medical care. So this is where we want to focus this episode. In the context of the need for achieving all these different healthcare behaviors, how do we do it? Of necessity, that means that we need to change the way we think, feel, believe, and therefore act. So how do we actually facilitate this change process? And just like the medical management is complex, so is the so-called behavior change management approach to diabetes. We often think that just education will do the trick, you know, tell someone about something related to their diabetes and they will do it. Well, it doesn't always work because attitudes, values, beliefs, culture, socialization, past experiences can modify our responses to the education that we receive. So I've painted a little bit of a background picture there, Stan. Where would you like to start in helping our listenership, both health professionals and people with diabetes and their caregivers, to understand this complex field of behavior change and its management?
I think it can be broken down into three kind of easier digestible components, is that whatever's going to be done in the context of change needs to be considered in the following. Is the change going to be made from a preventative point of view?
Right.
Is it going to be made because it is a treatment component, or is it made because of a maintenance aspect? And those are very different components. And let me just break that down. Is the behavior I'm going to do valuable in order to prevent a long-term harm occurring? And we know that structured physical activity, depending on its nature, whether it's an intensity or whether it's duration, has good scientific evidence that it can prevent and reduce the risk of cardiovascular death and cardiac events such as heart attacks. That's a preventative treatment. You're engaging in a behavior change deliberately. You had spoken about medication, which fits squarely into the treatment component. I'm taking a particular treatment in order to lower my blood glucose. It may be a pill, it may be an injection, it may be a GLP-1, as we had spoken about earlier. And lastly, which is perhaps the long haul, and we spoke about the much older person with diabetes in that sense, a lot of therapies and behavior changes and modifications that are made in diabetes are done from a maintenance point of view. I'm on this treatment. I'm still physically active. I'm careful with my nutrition because I'm maintaining my diabetes management within the preset ranges that I have. And therefore, if you can break down the needs of behavior changes into those three categories, recognizing as well that whatever happens over your diabetes time course, things are going to change.
Absolutely. Yeah. And guidelines around the world suggest that in addition to the normal annual review of your need for education and care, that there are at least four other times at which we should be reviewing your treatment approach. So that's at diagnosis, when you're not meeting your treatment targets, when there are complicating factors, whether those are physical health conditions or emotional factors or basic living needs, with so-called socioeconomic determinants of health that might influence your self-management, and when transitions in life and care occur.
Let me give you a common scenario that perhaps many of our listeners and healthcare workers may relate to. Think of an older person who lands up in hospital as a result of a complicated community-acquired pneumonia.
Right.
And prior to that admission, they had been well managed in respect to their diabetes, perhaps on one or two different types of diabetes medications. And during the hospitalization, because of a number of factors, including the cortisone they received, their poor appetite, and the fact that they needed glucose in the drips, their blood glucose levels elevated, and they were put on insulin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they come out of hospital carrying a bag of insulin or two or three different types of insulin. And because hospitals are not necessarily the most conducive places to spend time and sit quietly.
Right.
And they're not the most educationally conducive environments to spread knowledge and skills, particularly when commencing insulin.
Mm-hmm.
And the older person may have not come into hospital with their hearing aid. Perhaps the bed is needed because there's a more sick person who's coming in. The person, the family come home with this bag of insulin and very little instruction in terms of what to do. And that is a very common scenario in keeping with what you've exactly said, when there's been a change for the worse in this case and a transition of care. Listeners, if you've had such experiences, share with us, because, you know, it's a phone call we receive every day with one of our own clinic patients. We haven't been kept in the loop, and all of a sudden it's panic stations, 5 o'clock on a Friday, that nobody's taught Grandpa John how to use his insulin treatment that he had received for the last week. So your point is very well made, Michael.
I think there's some important principles that have come across, you see in the guidelines internationally, in approaching behavior change. One is that we need to take a more developmental approach. So, like I said just now, when we go through periods of transition, we change. We change physically, our life circumstances change, care has to therefore change, and so on. The other things that are very strong in guidelines are the focus on culture, because culture can help us perceive the education or guidance that we receive very differently. And so we need to understand how that person views the guidance in respect of their own culture. Another important thing is that we need to make informed decisions. So if we're going to make any change in what we do, we need to have the education so that we can make those informed decisions. The latest ADA guidelines point to the fact that only 53% of people on medical health insurance actually receive self-management education, which to me is shameful. And imagine those people who don't have such funding support. Another thing is collaborative care. So we need to work with our clients to do things together rather than telling them what to do. And the point is that we'd like to not only improve medical outcomes, but we'd also like to improve quality of life. And that's something that's coming through very strongly in all the literature, is that it's no good, let's say, achieving an HbA1c target of 7% if the quality of life sucks. That just doesn't help. So quality of life is now becoming an important indicator of the value of therapy. And then if we are going to facilitate behavior change, we need to have specialized skills in that area. So either we need, as healthcare professionals, to upskill ourselves in that area, or we need to refer to someone who does have those skills.
So here's my message for people with diabetes, and go back to my early primary school years. You know, I hated long division.
Me too.
I think all of us did.
Yeah.
Oh. And in those days, you didn't have calculators in grade two back in the mid-1970s. And the point is that perhaps you spent the entire grade 2 year doing long division. Mm. You know, addition, subtraction was relatively easy, but long division snagged most people. And the math teachers in those days persisted at it. It wasn't a single lesson you had on a Monday and at the end of the year you wrote an exam. Mm. And akin to the idea of education in that sense, many people will come for an initial education session. You spoke of specialists. Yep, I'm referring to the diabetes nurse specialist, somebody who's absolutely well-trained and themselves has acquired mastery, a word often used in the ADA guidelines in terms of the ability to provide sound education for people with diabetes. Mm-hmm. And akin to long division maths, it's not a single session that's ever going to suffice for an hour or even 45 minutes Whether you have a life change or a hiccup in your management, this is the person who's going to be responsible for your education, your support, part of the management of your diabetes, not necessarily the medical management of the diabetes or the operative management or the foot care management, but overall the education and support component of that. And if you have diabetes, or if you're a person looking after somebody who has diabetes involved in their care, bear in mind that that's an underutilized resource and it ought to be something that is an ongoing basis. It was never designed in all of the studies like the DCCT that you had spoken about to be a single session. In fact, I think the evidence says you need a minimum of 10 hours.
10 hours, absolutely.
As a person with diabetes to kind of have full value so that you can say, and you often hear this from people with diabetes, I still don't get it. Mm. And what that person is actually saying is, help me. I need to understand better. I need to understand differently. How else can we achieve that so that penny drops and they can actually master their own management at that point in time?
And I think the penny drops is a useful analogy, because to get to the point at which the penny drops and we are prepared to change takes time and it takes some stages of emotional and cognitive processing. And these have been summarized by Prochaska and DiClementi way back in 1977 with their stages of change. And they envisaged 5 steps of change. And I'm just going to go through them very quickly. You can look these up on the internet to get more of the meat. But there's a pre-contemplative stage, which essentially says, I'm not ready to change yet. They're not ready to take action now in the foreseeable future. And they even may be unaware that their current behavior is problematic. Let's say, for example, smoking. Then there's contemplation, where I'm maybe cognitively, emotionally getting ready. You're starting to recognize that a particular behavior may be problematic for your health, and you start looking and weighing up the pros and cons of changing your behavior, but you're not yet ready. Preparation is when you are, okay, doc or sister, I'm ready to change, and what can I do? The next thing is action, where we actually are engaged in doing the behavior change. The penny has dropped. We now say, let's pull out the soft drink or the bag of chips we bought from the vending machine and let's actually consume it. We make specific and overt actions to modify our problem behavior or in acquiring a newer, healthy behavior. And then, of course, we need to maintain that. And maintenance is regarded as that point in time, usually after about 6 months, where we've been engaging in a healthier behavior and it's largely now being concretized into our normal daily routine. Of course, there's a point of possible relapse, and that means we may often be going all the way back to the beginning. But maintenance must look at things like what are things that could make you want to go back to previous ways of behaving, and what are things that we can engage to avoid that? What are some support mechanisms, and so on? So I don't know if that helps to map out how we get the process going.
I think people with diabetes often come in for a consultation with the expectation that they ought to be angels, you know, 24/7, and recognize that that isn't likely for the majority of people with diabetes. And I like the byline the ADA used a couple of years ago. They said, diabetes is tough, but it's worth it.
Yeah.
And I think over the long haul, we need to recognize that these behavior changes, these modifications, whether they be preventative, treatment, or maintenance, as you just alluded to, will often lapse.
Right.
People go on holiday. People win prizes. I had a couple who were doing incredibly well. They won a prize and they went on a ship to the Portuguese islands. And
oh, wow.
Yep, they came back and I look after both of them. And they both acknowledged that the management of the diabetes kind of stayed behind in the dock in Durban and they went on holiday without their diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
I say that tongue in cheek and knew exactly what they were referring to. You know, just recognizing how hard it can be a lot of the time to kind of wear the yoke of diabetes with you, even on a ship, just that opportunity to stray for a moment. Now, that's not going to literally cost them an eye and a leg in that sense. And they're mindful enough to have recognized that they had a short break and it'll all be okay. We've spoken at length about those who kind of stray off the path for lengthy periods of time and maybe representative underlying mood disorders, eating disorders and the like. And you framed that very well, Michael. I think for people with diabetes and people who care for people with diabetes, when often asked, what treatment are you on for diabetes? I think the knee-jerk response is you name a pill or a jab or you say Ozempic proudly because you're wearing that badge at the moment. And I think that's not necessarily the correct answer. When somebody says, what is your treatment for diabetes? I want to frame it differently because the treatment of diabetes has now progressed beyond just the brand of the pill. As you said earlier, that's only an aspect of the therapy.
Absolutely.
And it's often very difficult to recognize which part of a big treatment is actually working and which part isn't. And I want to tell listeners today, healthcare workers and people with diabetes, that when I think of care for diabetes, I think of medical nutrition treatment supervised by a registered dietitian. I think of dedicated movement, which we now call exercise, and I think of drug therapy or therapeutic treatments. But what we also need to recognize in the holistic treatment of diabetes is how's your mental health? What kind of emotional support have you got? How's your sleep? And we recognize how poor sleep has an adverse impact on all aspects of diabetes.
For sure.
And lastly, what if the management of your diabetes also included just tech? What if you were an older person wearing one of these fancy continuous glucose monitoring, taking a little bit of metformin treatment because that's all you needed? Well, your management of diabetes isn't mild. You've got well-managed diabetes and you've onboarded a tech aspect as part of your diabetes. So for listeners out there, the management of diabetes can't be summed up and ought not to be summed up to just labeling the kind of pill. And you might say, how's the management of my diabetes? I'm sleeping well. I'm in a good mental health space at the moment and my blood glucose levels are in an acceptable range. That for me would sum up diabetes management.
For sure. I think, yeah, we're having a much more comprehensive look at diabetes self-management and how to achieve that. Having a look at the ADA guidelines on physical behaviors for type 2 diabetes, I was very impressed by an image they put in there. And, you know, in the past, we used to say, well, you need to be physically active for 150 minutes a week and you need to engage in resistance activity 2 to 3 times a week. And that was sort of it. But they've taken a very much more inclusive and encompassing view of physical activity, starting firstly with looking at physical activity as a 24-hour concept, which includes sleep. Physical activity needs a break. So they're putting in there that you need sufficient sleep, and that's usually about 7 to 8 hours in terms of quantity. The quality needs to be good, and obviously that's influenced by a number of things. And then when we wake up, we need to be reducing how long we are sitting. So breaking up periods of sitting into at least no more than 30-minute segments, and then looking at things like increasing the number of your steps. And recent evidence shows us that just 500 steps more per day is associated with a 2 to 9% decreased risk of cardiovascular mortality and all-cause mortality, and that just a 5 to 6 minute brisk intensity walk per day equates to a 4-year greater life expectancy. These are great things, and obviously, if you can do more than that, you get additive effects. So, breaking up prolonged sitting, increasing the amount of steps, and then getting into the usual physical activity per week of at least 150 minutes, they talk about sweating. And I think that's quite a nice way to characterize the level of intensity required, and then also to work at strengthening. And another often neglected thing is that of balance and proprioception, understanding where your joints are in relation to your space and direction of travel. So, with all the aspects of self-management, we are taking a far more comprehensive approach rather than just a few things like avoid carbohydrates or get more physically active or take your medications. We're trying to get across the understanding that all of these things are related, a bit like a spider web, and that if we influence one little area, it has tremors that influence all the other areas, and that all the areas work together to a better good, better clinical outcomes, better quality of life.
We're not specifically dwelling on the treatments for the management of type 1 or type 2 diabetes today.
No.
We're speaking more from those behavior point of view and embedded well within the aspects of the medical nutrition treatment, but worthy of commentary for any behavior change is this verbatim line specifically with regards to nutrition. It says, regardless of the eating pattern, meal plan, or dietary approach, long-term follow-up and support from members of the diabetes care team are needed to optimize outcomes and maintain behavior changes. So again, single visit to the registered dietitian at the start of diabetes isn't going to cut it over 30, 40 years of diabetes.
Not a chance.
And whilst we're not specifically talking about the impact of artificial sweeteners, which is dealt with in great depth here, that's something that hadn't come up historically, and it's something that's topical now. And if that's a topic you and the registered dietitian have not had a conversation about, and it's important to you because you like to bake at home, or you are an avid consumer of carbonated beverages with artificial sweeteners, it's worth popping in and having that conversation. There was some talk about cancer. There was talk about safety of these treatments.
Right.
And whilst it's not the place of this podcast to go into any depth in that sense, it's certainly something that's of great interest for many, many people with diabetes as well as their families, because very often the household will be shopped for, so to speak, and those beverages will come on board. And we know that there is some emerging evidence that artificially sweetened carbonated beverages are not necessarily the most healthy and appropriate choices, and water would be a better choice as per the ADA. Coming back to that idea is that long-term follow-up and support are required for any of these behavior changes over time. And we don't expect people with diabetes to come in once for any aspect of their care and imagine that it isn't going to change and they aren't going to need that long-term kind of looking after in terms of our support as healthcare providers.
Absolutely. Something I just wanted to bring up was the point of technology. And we've spoken many times on the show about the place of technology as an enabler. And probably 10 years ago, when the International Diabetes Federation brought out its guidelines on self-home glucose monitoring, that's the traditional finger prick capillary blood glucose monitoring, they said that it was actually pointless to engage in this activity if both the person with diabetes and the health practitioner lacked the education, the knowledge and the insight as to what to do with the resulting data. And I think that in the current potential overload of data that can accrue from technologies such as continuous glucose monitoring, that older advice stands even stronger today. And guidelines like the ADA guidelines emphasize that technology will only work, will only produce optimal benefits if there is a two-way back and forth communication with the diabetes team to analyze the results, to reflect on the results, and provide feedback.
Michael, as we come to the last portions of the podcast, and in keeping with the way the guidelines were laid out, they spent a lot of time talking about psychosocial care and mental health matters, something that has not ever really made its way into the mainstream. And I'm ever so grateful for COVID, I say that tongue in cheek, for having really brought out mental health matters into the mainstream for us in healthcare. Certainly been around, but COVID has laid it bare in that sense. And if one in four people with type 2 diabetes have features compatible with mild or moderate depression, then that's a big deal that 25% of any clinic's patients are going to need additional support. Again, you come to your diabetes consultation as a person with diabetes or somebody who cares for somebody with diabetes. Don't leave if that aspect of the care hasn't been touched on. Because very often, if diabetes management is not okay, it's not because the pill isn't working. Perhaps the person isn't taking the pill because they can't afford the copay on their current medical aid plan, and giving them a more expensive, newer pill ain't going to help their diabetes management. Perhaps they're not taking their pill because they're an older person and are forgetful.
Right.
Perhaps they're not taking their pill because they feel they're on too many pills and haven't really had a sound conversation with their nurse specialist or their healthcare provider as to why each of these individual components is important and what they do differentially. In other words, when looking at the outcome, and let's assume the outcome is not good diabetes management, always ask the question why.
Absolutely.
Not the knee-jerk responses, let's give more medicine, I've heard of Ozempic, let's add that in the vain hope. These are expensive drugs, and if the practitioner has an agenda to push expensive drugs, it can add greater concern, and if people don't feel comfortable expressing their financial constraints in front of the practitioner, it's only going to add worse. So my plea in terms of an advocacy component would be, come armed to the consultation with what are your needs at this particular visit. They may not be the needs for the next visit, but right now, what's the conversation we're going to have? You've waited 6 months to see your practitioner, or perhaps 3 months to see your diabetes nurse. It's your agenda. Tell us what's on your mind. Let us aid you in getting better diabetes management.
For sure. And that's a point well made, Stan. I would encourage health practitioners out there, when we do a two-way conversation about a change in therapy, to always finish with, what do you think or feel about what we've just discussed? And hopefully preemptively abort the potential problems that may arise. You've been speaking about advocacy, Stan, and in that light, we're going to close out the show. Kirsten from SA Diabetes Advocacy is still on leave. So the following is an advocacy message from us here in the CDE Academy. The CD Academy joins with SA Diabetes Advocacy to support an insulin advocacy petition by the Society of Endocrinology, Metabolism and Diabetes of South Africa, otherwise known by the acronym SEMSDA. A recent contract circular in state healthcare, which details insulin options for people with diabetes, has reverted to the supply of vials and syringes instead of the previously supplied insulin pens. While this no doubt is motivated by cost considerations, insulin vials and syringes are an outdated mode of insulin delivery and are difficult to use. They may contribute negatively both to quality of life for people with diabetes and poor continued medication adherence. This raises the risk of physically and financially costly long-term complications of diabetes. We appeal to you to sign the SEMSDA insulin petition. Check out the show notes of this episode for a link to the CD Academy Facebook post on the issue, which bears the SEMSDA appeal letter for your further information and the petition link. So listeners, thank you very much for joining us for this episode. We hope that you have gained something to reflect on, to engage either with your healthcare practitioner or with your clients with diabetes. And please feel free to share your experiences with us on our email address, podcast@cdediabetes.co.za. And we look forward to being with you again next week.
That's a bye from me too. And I look forward to you joining us on our 50th episode when we return.
Over and out from us. Thank you for joining us on Not Artificially Sweetened, where we aim to build bridges of insight and understanding between people with diabetes and the health professionals that facilitate their care. Anything we discuss is for your reflection, education, personal growth, and entertainment only. You join this podcast at your own risk, and we are not responsible for any omissions, errors, or unwanted medical outcomes. Please note the following important, specific disclaimers. For people with diabetes, the health professionals on this podcast are not your personal caregivers. Always discuss any new information with your diabetes team before acting on any aspect of it. The views and opinions discussed are those of the hosts only and do not represent those of any other entity. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you encounter in this session. Anything you learn or experience here cannot substitute for personalized, professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. For health professionals working in diabetes, always discuss any new information with your clinical team before acting on any aspect of it. You are personally accountable and liable for any choices made in a clinical setting according to your level of training and legal scope of practice. Any information or insights gained here must be used with your professional discretion and with the developing base of clinical evidence, local and organizational laws, regulations, guidelines, and protocols. Good luck with your diabetes care missions. Till next time.